Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Chris Fogarty, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. Nice to be here.
Prior to founding Fogarty Finger in 2003, Chris Fogarty was a senior designer at Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill Architects, SOM, in London, Washington, D.C., and New York, playing a significant role in national and international competitions and completing many award-winning office and mixed-use buildings. Chris's current and recently completed projects include the Dime Building, the Dime Bank Building in Brooklyn, a new 23-story tower merging retail, commercial, and multifamily residential units adjoining the existing Dime Bank, the Jackson, which is a 56-unit condominium building near MoMA PS1, that's Public School One in Long Island City in New York, and The Lanes, the first co-living micro suites project in New York City. So doing a lot of work, a lot of commercial work, a lot of multifamily work. I'd love to talk today with you, Chris, about the way our world has changed, right? We're coming out of a pandemic here. There's some permanent changes. There were some temporary changes. It's affected everything. Right? It's changed the way we work and we live and we play. And so I'd love to talk about that, how the pandemic has affected our world, our built world, and our practice, the way we practice. But before we get into that conversation, I'd love to learn more about you as a person, as an architect. Share your origin story. When did you discover architecture, and who or what inspired you to become an architect?
Well, as you can probably tell, I'm not from here. I'm a long way from home and haven't been home for a year and a half. I mean, I think we're all probably struggling with that, that our parents and family that are close to, and certainly for my office here, I've got lots of people who work from overseas. I mean, you know, we used to be able to touch base and connect in a way that we haven't been able to do. But I came here about 20-odd years ago now, but I grew up in Devon on a small seaside town, far from anything. I just loved drawing, couldn't stop drawing. I was addicted. You know, it's what I did. If it was
what did you draw? What was your topic?
Oh, fantastical cities, you know, birds, superheroes, you know, like anything I could draw. Like, you know, I talking to my daughter the other day, like I used to draw Spider-Man. I couldn't believe, you know, they could draw a person in six strokes, and it would, you know, you'd just be like blown away, and they somehow caught movement and everything. So I drew and drew and drew, and I guess I was good at art, and thought about art school, thought about lots of different things. But then I did a history project when I was 15 on my school, which was designed by an architect this kind of high Victorian, William Butterfield, and he had done my school as a kind of precursor to Keble College, which was one of his bigger buildings at Oxford. And I went up to the Victoria and Albert Museum up in London as a 15-year-old, and you could go into the kind of drawings collection, and they pulled out, open a drawer, and there were the original watercolors for my school.
Oh, wow.
And I was blown away. I was like, wow, you can do this and get paid for it. I mean, like, this is great. So, you know, I didn't have much idea what I was doing. You know, nowadays, I think, you know, certainly the better schools have huge career advisors and, you know, people advising you, and parents seem to be more organized. I mean, but my parents didn't really have a clue. You know, I just applied to a bunch of architecture schools with no real knowledge of anything about it or what the course was or anything other than I thought I could draw and I kind of liked buildings. And I got into most of them, and I thought I'd go to Liverpool. That seemed nice. And my father said, no one goes to Liverpool by choice. He said, people spend their lives trying to get out of there, which is, I'm sorry for anybody from Liverpool. And he said, where else have you got into? And I said, well, I got into this place called the Bartlett at London University. And he said, well, go there. And that little did I know, that was the best school in the country. So there I was, you know, some little country kid and all these sophisticates. And but I loved it and had a great time and learned a huge amount. Then I did my postgraduate up at Edinburgh University. And I kind of fell in love with the city again there. It was just, I don't know if you've ever been. I mean, Edinburgh is, they call it the Athens of the North, and it is breathtakingly beautiful. You come out of the train station, I fell in love. I mean, like, I've fallen in love a few times in my life, but that was the first time really with a city. And so that was that, and met a great professor there and sort of started that was that. And I came back down to London, and it was just really, it was in the early 90s. And I think in the US, it was the same way. Like, it seems to me strange. We've been through the Great Recession, we've been through this terrible pandemic, but actually in 1992, it was far harder for an architect to find a job than it is today. Sure. I mean, we're all scarred by that. And I look at my office and they're all kind of innocently kind of still getting a paycheck. I mean, there was no work at all. So I thought I'd have to go off to, you know, go off to Berlin. Everyone was going to Berlin in the UK because Berlin had been, you know, Germany had been unified, and they were building like no, and didn't matter if you didn't speak German, everybody was there, all my friends were there. So I thought, well, that's it. I worked for somebody for free in London, but it wasn't really sustainable. And then I went off, and I thought I was going to give in my notice with my roommates and say I'm off. And then I got a job with a landscape firm around the corner. And I was like, for a week, and I stayed there for a year, and I loved it. I learned everything about thinking about the seasons, thinking about space between buildings, a whole different world that I hadn't been taught at school. And they were doing a project with SOM London, and you know, I'd go in, and we were doing the hard landscaping or something, you know, and the partner in the London office took a shine to me, and he said, you don't seem like a normal landscape architect. And I said, well, actually, I'm an architect. And he said, well, you want to come here? And so I was their first hire in the London office. They'd been 400 people, and they'd gone down to 40.
Wow.
I mean, that's how awful it was.
Yeah.
And so I was their first hire there, and I stayed there for 5 years. And then I was getting kind of restless. I'd been dumped by my girlfriend. It was time to do something else. And I thought I'd travel. I went and got myself a job in Hong Kong, and I came back and resigned from SOM London. And they said, there was somebody I'd worked with in New York, and he said to a partner, he said, look, maybe you want to get this guy. So they brought me over to, they said, look, don't leave. Do you want to go to Washington, D.C.? We need a senior designer. And I was kind of a squirt. You know, I wasn't, you know, I was doing projects in Potsdam and Germany and various things, but I wasn't running anything. I was just, you know, somebody who they threw onto something to help. So, but they pulled me over to DC, and I arrived with a little suitcase and nothing else. And then I suddenly realized I had this team of 15 people and they thought I was a senior designer. So I sort of fell into it. And
So what did you do in that moment? Did you admit that you didn't know and allowed them to help you, or did you just play the role?
I just played the role. Yep. And worked really, really hard, like triply as hard as I could. And we won some competitions, and then they moved me up to New York, and we won a few more competitions. And, you know, then it was kind of, you know, but then I kind of felt like I was running out of the runway at SOM, and it's, you know, it's interesting. I loved the firm. I loved what they did. I loved the scale of the work. I'm not super detail oriented. So the kind of the big picture has always intrigued me. And, but, you know, the partners, you do the math, it's like a law firm, except no one ever leaves. So, you know, the partners were 42, 45. I was maybe 30. They retire at 60, so that I had 15 years before there was an opening for me to become a partner. And you can just kind of, and also you sort of, you know, in that time, you watch the people ahead of you, they just run out of runway as well. So you watch these senior people, great talented people, but you know, it's a kind of machine, and you could just do the math and see it wasn't going to work. And it was probably better to jump ship. So that was it. So I just went in, and I had a very nice relationship with the partner I worked with. And I said, look, I'm quitting. And he said, well, I guess that was, you always go to do that. So I'm surprised it's taken so long. But he said, when are you leaving? I said, I don't know. I said, actually, I already got to the quitting part. I haven't actually got a plan. And he said, well, when you got a plan, let me know. So I think 6 months later, and I kind of finally found a space, and then they let me have a bunch of old furniture, the office manager, you know, like they were incredibly supportive. I was finishing a tower up on Times Square, and the client wanted me to finish that. I was just the design person, but if they had questions, they wanted to be able to ask me. So that was kind of my first project. And the other first project I had was a student's bathroom in West Village. So I'd have these completely strange experiences where I'd be going up a hoist of a 55-story building, feeling like I was somebody, and then I'd be running off to Home Depot to buy a toilet seat. And, that was my new life. And so that was that. And then we kind of getting it up and running. And
so when was that? How long were you at SOM?
2003. So that was 18 years ago or something. And so, then I...
So about how many years? 10 years?
I was 10 years at SOM, yeah.
10 years.
Okay. You know, I kept on trying to quit. I mean, like, that was the thing. They just kept on finding better roles for me.
Yeah.
And then I... so I was doing these projects, and it's very hard. I mean, you've been there, like starting a practice, you think all your clients are going to come with you. They don't. You know, they need SOM because that's going to get the financing, and no one's going to trust anybody else to do anything. But they had great relationships with them all. So, you know, if they needed a bathroom redesigning in an office building, they might give us a shout. And then I had a client, and I think this is one of the big breakthroughs for me, was that I had a client who, a friend who had a law firm. They were looking for someone to just expand half a floor or something. And I didn't know anything about interiors. And I hate, even though when I said at SOM Washington, I didn't lie. I just didn't tell them that I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
But if they'd asked me, I would have said, I think it's much better to be straight up and honest with people. And so I didn't want to let my friend down who was bringing us to the table. So I needed somebody who could do interiors. And I asked Robert, who I'd known at SOM, who'd left as well. And I said, you want to come and join us and we'll make a pitch for this. And we got the job. And I think the big thing that I've been really thankful for all these years is that I got a partner that I really trust right at the start. And that has made growing and thinking about the firm and talking strategically and making decisions so much easier. I can't imagine doing this without somebody that you trust implicitly to come along for the ride.
When you started the firm, did you think maybe I'll have a partner, or was it not really part of the plan until you had this opportunity?
wasn't really part of the plan. And we kind of started, you know, I didn't really know him well that well. I mean, he was in a different group. He was in the interiors group and I was on the ground upside at SOM. So we said, look, and I'd kind of set up this funny little structure for Fogarty Architects it was then, but I said, well, why don't we call ourselves Fogarty Finger and let's just work together for a year. And if we like each other at the end of the year, we'll make it official and we'll—
So you just stayed separate companies.
Yeah.
Marketed as one.
Marketed as one. And I think that's kind of, that was a smart move. It took all the pressure out of it, having to work, you know.
How did you deal with contracts for that? Just one of you took the contract and then worked?
It would be Fogarty Architects. But, you know, they didn't really care. Like the contracts are so small. No one's really asking heavy questions. And, you know, so we would do that. And we did a lot of, like, bit by bit, we'd get an apartment. The apartments would get bigger. Then we'd get like a townhouse and we'd get another townhouse. And so, and then we had that kind of side going. And the corporate side was kind of quiet, wasn't super busy, but we did get some multifamily work of apartment and building multifamily interiors, like for big companies like Avalon Bay, strangely. And so we sort of started getting ourselves a little bit more organized. You know, we kind of grew slowly. It was very slow at first, like two people, three people. But it was fun. And it was a different sort of scale than we'd both been used to. You know, he'd been used to doing 500,000 square foot buildings versus for Goldman. I'd been used to doing towers. This kind of getting detailed and oriented and thinking about spaces and really how people use space, how people use a kitchen, how, you know, like all this stuff, which we just blissfully had no idea about for many years, came up and forefront and really helped us change the way we thought about space and architecture. And I think really gave us a kind of great foundation. And I think it's one of the things that I'm most grateful for is we had these kind of years before we started rolling it back into the stuff we had been doing of really learning about residential architecture in a really helpful way. And kind of interestingly was really current because hospitality and residential feeling was beginning to come into everything. You know, like the commercial workspaces were getting much more thinking about how to make them feel less like an office before COVID. And that was going on in multifamily buildings as well, is that, you know, these lounges and different sorts of spaces that gyms, yogas, pools, pantries, kitchens, wine tasting, all that stuff was beginning to happen as well. And so that residential kind of language that we learned and developed actually got us just right at the right part of the where that market started moving into the other, into our worlds. So that was kind of interesting. And then it started kind of rolling. And you've always got to find, you know, my big advice for anybody starting a practice is find the crazy first client. You've always, like, you've got to find that client that is either so cheap or so nutty or so naive or a mixture of all three that doesn't realize that you don't know what you're doing and is willing to take the risk on you. And if you get exposure to anyone like that, jump and don't worry about the fee. Just get that first building or that first project done, because then all the others come following.
So what was your first crazy client? What was your the client or the project or both?
Well, you know, the nice thing about leaving SOM on a nice terms, most people get fired from SOM. They're not really used to people leaving, you know, TJ, who was a partner there, recommended me to a friend of his cousins, of his whatever. And this guy was complete, he had no idea what he was doing. John, he was lovely. He bought a piece of land in Long Island City and we developed this completely unbuildable building for him. And of course, then the market kind of moved and he was left holding it. And a kind of really aggressive Israeli client came in, bought the land and partnered with John. And that guy was our first client, AL. And he was great and fantastic. And he got that thing built. And then we did another 6 or 7 buildings with him.
So once you get that first big commission, then you could market to that. And
that's right.
Find more clients like that one.
And I've seen this happen with friends of mine who started practices. And I remember an engineer once who he was like, I said, look, Mark, I'd really love you to come and be the engineer on this project with me. And he just left a big company and he was with his father's firm or something. He said, well, I'm going to have to give it a really big fee because I've never done this before. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like,
that's not good, however you look at it.
Yeah, I'm like, how's that going to work? He's like, well, I can't afford to lose money. And I'm like, but you're never going to get out of the sort of work you're doing. And so I think that's often part of the risk analysis is like, you know, okay, is this, I feel out of my depth and I'm probably not going to make much money here or if anything, but I need to get that project up and running so I can kind of get more of it. And then the other thing is all these clients that I had from SOM, you know, the youngsters who were working there for these big kind of corporate clients, they all go off and start their own thing as well. So they would always call me because, so you would get this kind of, you get these kind of new clients that never, you know, just, but mainly all word of mouth recommendation. And bit by bit, it started growing. And I think we're about 120 people now, which is kind of crazy.
And you focus primarily on commercial and multifamily?
Yeah. I mean, we're definitely a corporate firm in that sense. And I think, you know, we're very strategic about how we try and get, I think one of the things that SOM taught us is, you know, design is foremost and fundamentally the most important thing we do here. But you can lose a client if you don't know or understand what they're trying to say to you. And I think one of the things that both Robert and I have is a very good ability to help look at things from the client's point of view, but then be able, so we can answer all the questions that they may throw at us because we've already thought about what the answers are. So they're not, so you can kind of, one, you can keep the project running very smoothly and speedily and quickly, but two, you're not also battling in on something that doesn't need to be battled about, or more importantly, you're never going to win because you don't understand the way that they're thinking. So, you know, we try and that was one of the reasons I left SOM was as well, is that I really hated the wasted time of pulling all-nighters to present free schemes and then to have them value engineered down to nothing. So there's an, like, it seemed to me there was a much more logical way you could navigate through this, where you didn't have to.
How do you do that differently now?
It's interesting. You sort of, on a multifamily building, you almost know the market as well as they do. So, but you also, so, you know, if they're starting saying, look, I want to do 3 bedrooms in, and they all need to be 2000 square feet, you kind of, either you run for the door, you know, in a market, in a place where the market's only 1 bedrooms and studios, you know, you sort of like, you don't believe them. So you sort of, you can't tell them that they're wrong. You know, you just kind of listen, or you kind of help navigate them there. You try and get them there before they price it out, because otherwise you're going to do all these drawings and they just can't afford the building.
Yeah.
So it's that sort of thing. It's, or, you know, if there's various filing and code, like that is perhaps the hardest. That was the hardest thing for me coming out of SOM. I just knew how to design buildings, and there were a bunch of people who knew how to get buildings built.
Right.
I had to become that person who learned how to get buildings built and what the process was. So, you know, understanding how New York City works, or how Jersey City works, or how it works in Atlanta or Boston, you have to kind of, you can't wing it. You have to know it so you can help your clients through it. So getting really educated about everything you're doing in advance is the key, I think, to try and give them strategic advice. And then sitting with your staff before meetings and going through and kind of explaining to them why that isn't going to work out, you know, like why you have to go this way. And so you can spend your energy focused on design instead of being focused on trying to fix the problems you created 6 months before because you didn't think of where this was going to line up.
Do you tend to have that happen less now that you have 18 years of experience doing these types of projects, and they just trust you about more?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that are nice. One is I have more experience, and so I have knowledge. More importantly, I've got people who've been around me now for a long time. And that's actually, I think, the better piece is like what was good at SOM is they had so much inbuilt knowledge, right? And it would transfer generation to generation, but they were 200-300 people, and there were people you could go to. When we started, we didn't have that, right? It was just me trying to look through the code book and understand it, or even worse, the zoning and trying to understand New York City zoning, which is just terrifying. And now my senior people have that experience and they can share it, and I can go to them and ask. I don't have to try and remember everything. I can go, what's that fire corridor thing we need now in Jersey that we didn't used to before? You know, so that sort of stuff gets a lot easier. So I think it does get easier. The difficulty is that as you get bigger, you get more of it. You've got more work. I think I keep reminding myself, I have to remind myself, there's a lot of really, as my wife says, architects are the only people who care about how big their firm is. Everybody else is concerned about what their profit is. she's like, what is it with you guys? She has a term for it. She says, she can't even talk to me about the way we think about finances. She calls it archimath, where none of it makes any sense to anybody outside of the architecture world. And it doesn't actually make any sense to architects either, but it's what we convince it is we need to keep going.
I think we're experiencing a lot of head nodding right now with the listeners. Yep. Then we get that archy math. Yep.
I mean, the best thing we did 5-6 years ago is, we started thinking about succession, which is actually truly the unknown. Like, if anybody's figured it out, that's the target. But we had somebody come in because we started thinking about what is succession, what does that mean, how do we do that, and it was a really painful process, conceptually, but we had this guy who was a business consultant, he was a landscape architect, but he taught at Harvard to the architect students about the business side of everything. His name is Brian, and that was fantastic and taught Robert and I to think of our firm not just as like an architect would, which is how many people and where did you get published and everything else, but actually think of it as this business. And he had this great piece of advice, which was, we never think of the business. We always think about design. Like, I'd much rather design a building than think about, why are we not making profit on these projects and how do we go get change orders for this? Because that's kind of really depressing. But he said, think of your business as a design project and give it the same care and thought that you give to a design project. And it doesn't have to be all the time, but don't push it away. Embrace it and enjoy it and take the best out of it. And I think that was really useful for Robert and I to sort of just think of it like that, and think of the other thing, which is is thinking of our work. It's kind of the quality of our work directly impacts the how much fee we can charge for it, right? And this concept of a brand, and architects don't like to think of ourselves as brands, but in fact that's what we're selling to people, and we can charge more money if we do it better than others,
right?
And then you can also get better staff because they want to come and work for you as
well.
So it's a big cycle. So I think that was super important for us as well, to think of to embrace the business side of it and not be scared of that.
The better the business, the higher the fees, and the more fees you have, the more profit you have, and the more profit you have, the more you can build your business to be a better business.
That's right. And you can pay your staff well.
Right.
It really is sort of crazy how that works. And I think we ended up in the multifamily and the group. We're kind of interesting because we're effectively two firms. Most practices are an architectural practice that dabbles in interiors because they have some interior side that they need to fulfill. Or they're an interior firm that has some ground up because they have a few clients who want to do that. And you can kind of see that happening. Like Studios was an interiors firm, but they now have architecture. Gensler was an interiors firm, now has architecture.
Yep.
SOM, though, was an architecture firm that had some interiors. From the start, we were an architecture and interiors firm, and our offices kind of split 50-50. it's very nice for client if you want to come to us and you have a building. We did the Dime building in Brooklyn is like 200,000 square feet of office and maybe 200,000 square feet of residential. Well, because we can do the ground up, the residential and the business and all the interiors, it's very nice for our clients to have that kind of ability to have one firm. And they might talk to Robert on the interiors and I might not even get involved, you know, that I'll just trust Robert implicitly that his team will do that and we'll focus on the ground up. So it's nice like that. And I think also, you know, everything's built in New York City. There's very little space left to build new buildings. Yeah, so you kind of are by default most of the time doing a lot of interior work anyway. So, you know, it's been good.
Let's take a break to thank our sponsors for their support of this episode. As architecture demand increases toward pre-pandemic levels and beyond, how are you and your architecture firm keeping up? RCAT is here to help. RCAT.com offers several free tools to help architecture and design firms like yours get work done faster. Use RCAT's powerful search engine to find the right products for your projects and download BIM, CAD, and specifications right there on the same page without needing to pay or register. It's free. RCAT.com also offers product videos, catalogs, green reports, product certification information, outline and short form specification generation, and so much more. Visit RCAT.com today. RCAT.com is your one-stop solution to help increase your productivity and get more projects done faster. That's RCAT.com, ARCAT.com. FreshBooks makes it simple to send invoices, post your expenses automatically, track your time for your whole team by project, and get organized with financial reports, communication, and notifications. My favorite feature in FreshBooks is the automated invoice reminders. I think sending invoices and getting paid is one of the biggest barriers to our success as entrepreneur architects. Who has the time? But if we don't send out the invoices, we don't get paid, right? FreshBooks makes it easy to send out your invoices and get paid fast, online, with a click of a button. And when your client doesn't pay you on time, FreshBooks will send them a friendly email reminder through a simple system that you control. Sign up for a free 30-day unrestricted trial and get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid faster. Go to entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks and enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community.
Have you seen any changes in the way you're designing because of the pandemic?
Yeah, not as well. I mean, I think is probably the biggest change. Because,
what do you mean by that?
Well, we were able to flip over and go remotely very quickly. And I was sort of I spend most of my time expecting doomsday scenarios to play out all the time. I'm completely, you know, so finally something happened that was serious.
Yeah, I was right.
Yeah. And I was filling the basement with supplies and my wife, this is back in like January, and my wife was just, you know, getting ready to get me certified. And I was like, no, this is going to be serious. And so we had our entire office, was set up remotely. And so, and our staff from China just stopped coming in. Like at some point they were like, you guys are nutty, even getting on the subway, like we're not coming in. So, you know, I think March 12th, like everybody, we just shut everything down. But we, at least a month before that, we had everybody up and running remotely so they could go home. And we'd found Teams, like we'd found all this software that we had for free that you could actually do all this remote working with. And we'd also used iPads for a long time. I'm a big believer in iPads and trying to get people to draw instead of going into the computer and getting lost in real, you know, actual real space. Like I keep trying to get people to pull back and imagine, you know, just get the information you need to get across rather than getting lost in right. the detail of one-to-one.
So you're using iPads like sketchbooks?
Yeah, all the time. And we have everybody has an iPad, almost everyone in the office. And with Teams, you can draw and communicate at the same time as you're sharing with everyone. You know, everyone can see it on the screen. But even for the guys going to site, you know, they can take a photograph, sketch on it, send it. And the beauty is there's no scanning or anything else. It's all instantaneous. So the iPad's been really useful. But I think the difficulty is that the way we work is that the team would be, we'd have everybody, I'd walk around and I'd be kind of nervous that we'd have a meeting coming up in a day, and I'd go over to their desk and they'd be on 3D and SketchUp or whatever. And I'd be able to sit there and the other guys would come around and stand around us, and I'd say, well, can you do this? Can you do that? And we'd kind of move quickly, and I'd be like, well, is this good? Am I losing it? Like, somebody speak up now before we put this to bed. And, you know, the senior people could just sit and come and talk to me and talk about design. And design could be this thing that was at that moment when you were talking, not around your desk, rather than being like, okay, let's talk at 2:15. And so what I found with this has been a lot of me marking things up and trying to get it back to them and then talking through it. But it's been less horizontal than I would like.
Yeah. You know, the spontaneity is gone. Yeah. And the serendipity that comes with being able to walk past somebody's desk and seeing the work they're doing.
Exactly.
Those meetings that pop up. And
yeah. So, you know, it's time to come back. I mean, I'm sitting here in my office and there's just me. And now I'm vaccinated. We're surveying our staff, they're all getting vaccinated. So we're beginning to, we've said Labor Day to come back, but, you know, we've got people all across the country now. You know, we told them, we tried to be very upfront with all the decision-making we've tried to do. And if we haven't been able to commit to anything, we've just said, look, we don't know. We like, this pandemic's proven anything. It's just, you can't plan anything.
Yeah, that's for sure. Everybody thought 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's right.
We'll be back to normal.
I
didn't.
I was like, I was no, like,
you,
oh, no.
You had the basement.
I had supplies for 6 months down in that basement. But we realized that, you know, September last year, people were coming up with leases. Like, how long do I sign a lease for? Am I still, you know, people have been in a little apartment in New York or Manhattan or Brooklyn for, you know, 6 months and going out of the mines. And it was, you know, as the sun comes out, it's hard to remember how depressing it was in November. So we said, guys, look, if you need to take a lease for a year. If we're going to aim for September to come back, but January, you know, 22 will be when we expect everybody to be fully back. And we still don't really know how it's going to work either. Are we going to still have part of the office in, part of the office out?
I was going to ask that. Whether you come back as a hybrid model.
I'm a great believer in, you don't need to be at the forefront. Like, there's some really smart companies with billions of dollars of revenues to figure this stuff out. And we're just a little architect's practice. So I'm just going to kind of watch and see what they do and track it a bit. The remote thing works just fine. I mean, I think part of the difficulty now is that people have gotten like it. And I think hybrid working is going to be a perk. And our competitors are going to offer it. So even if you, the tricky part is you can be all out or you can be all in. When you start having three people in the office, three people out of the office, a client that wants to come in and see all the people there, it gets a little harder. And I think that's the bit that we're going to try and navigate our way through.
I think that's going to be the piece that everybody's trying to figure out. That the whole idea, we know that it works, right? We've been doing it for over a year. The preference is to be in the office, to have everybody there from a leadership point of view. From a staff point of view, it's probably mixed, right? Some probably like being home, some probably like being in the office. But clients will have expectations and the work will have requirements. Right, there'll be some type of work like the design work that you're talking about. Some of that,
or material selection. I mean, throughout this whole thing, we've had to have people come in and just because you have to have the materials come somewhere. And we've been sending out like free sets of everything to clients in three different places. So instead of having one meeting where they all come to you, we've been more like a shipping company in here. I mean, like, we had to move the multifamily interiors group. We had to move them out of the main space because they were such a mess. It was just horrible. So yeah, I think my wife thinks it's going to be a bit like, the banks all went casual when in the .com because Google was taking all the best minds and they wanted everybody to not feel like they needed to let everybody feel like they had some choice about what they could wear and not wear suits. So you had this kind of awful moment where Wall Street was full of these really bad looking golf shirts and khakis and, and then, they started seeing that their boss was going to a meeting and she might be wearing a suit or he might be wearing a tie. And suddenly they realized, they might have to go to a meeting. They didn't know if they were that day. And they did. So they started wearing. So now you've got this thing where everybody wears, the men at least, wear suits with no ties. But that's kind of gone back to being the uniform for Wall Street and banking. And my guess is that we'll see something like that, where the hybrid will kind of start off and then just bit by bit, people will start realizing that, so-and-so got promoted over me, but is that because I was, only in the office once a week and they were there every day, or such-and-such got a better job than I did, and why did that happen? And I think you'll see that sort of slowly. I don't think we'll be trying to force it with an iron. My guess is it'll just kind of happen.
Yeah, the system will adjust itself in order to be at its optimum.
Or we get variants coming through every 5 minutes, and this is where my doomsday scenario comes in. And we have to. So one of the things we're doing for hybrid is, we did everybody. You could either log into the office, or you could take your computer back home. And then have that computer log into the server. So you had two ways of doing it. It went 50-50. So we've got about 50 people who have their desktops back at their home. And so we're in the process now of buying another 50 computers to fill those blank spots in the office so that they can come into the office, but also have the ability to go work at home.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And all our associates and senior people were getting laptops for the same reasons, so we can get their computers back here. Doubling down on technology.
That's a permanent change, right?
That's a permanent change.
Essentially, you're going to have duplicate equipment, so you have a hybrid model.
That's right. And then we have the ability to flip back and forth depending on what happens.
Yeah.
I think the things that are going to be great are, certainly for working mothers in particular, we've always tried to offer flex time, but flex time used to be more like, I'll work 3 days a week and the other 2 days I won't. But our working mothers, one of them called me the other day and she just loves this. She's an incredible worker, but she just loves the ability to kind of log in, log out. And I think we're going to see that becoming much more. I think, waiting for the cable guy to turn up. It used to be you have to lose a whole day of your life, right? They come between 9 and 12 and turn up at 3. Well, now you can just work at home all day. You don't need to lose a vacation day or anything for that. So I think it's definitely here. There's no excuses. I can't say to anybody, that's not going to happen. Can't work. They're like, it does.
Exactly. And that was the reason why no one was making, few people were making that transition prior to the pandemic, because it was a hard transition to make. And so you could say the excuse was that, that's not going to work. We don't work that way. And then it was, in 2 weeks we started working that way and everything changed.
We've got an interesting thing. So our lease is up here in a couple of years. And, so at the moment we're just doing patches to our office. But, we had some open plan conference rooms. We're making those partitioned and glass screens. We're increasing the ventilation. We also got some basement space that we're going to kit out with more conference rooms and everything else. But what's going to be interesting is you know, our new lease will be somewhere wherever we go 2 or 3 years' time, is trying to think about what we do for that. And again, we're going to just kind of wait and see. We're going to, like, we've got the luxury of not having to make those calls right now.
Yeah.
And in fact, most of our corporate clients, the tenants are doing the same thing. They extended their leases everywhere for an extra 2 years. So when this started, so they bought time. But, you know, we're going to have this strange thing in New York City in 2 years where every lease is up. Like, you've got 3 years of leasing all coming together at one point. It's going to be ridiculously busy. But people are hopeful that we'll know what sort of future we're in.
Right.
And it's very hard. You know, we're meant to be looking at this and being the forecasters, but Robert and I are kind of skeptical and that it's going to be that drastically different, that we just don't see it. But
that's, you know, interesting, because I mean, you guys know better than anyone, you're designing those spaces, and that was actually going to be one of my questions, was that, do you see a trend happening now for those future workspaces? But it sounds like, much like what we're talking about here, a lot of those companies will wait and see before they make those changes.
I think
those
trends will come later. I think there's certainly companies where, say, if you're a management company and you managed a bit, like, the more independent you were as individuals working in an organization, I think there they've realized that you really can reduce head. You just don't need as much space. Like, not everybody has to come in all the time. For the more creative companies like ours, you know, we can't even make hot desking work because, you know, on everybody's desk is a pile of materials or samples or, you know, like, and they have all their computer settings set up. So we'll see if you know, that's one of the big ones that we'll try and see if we can kind of find some way to reduce the dependence of people on their particular desk. But I just don't know. The big thing that we were doing before, and I think we'll continue even more so, is one of the things I've loved is, you know, during the day, I can get up from the desk I have at home, go sit on the couch, think about things there, then go into the kitchen, have a coffee, make myself lunch. Like, I can move around during the day. And we were doing a lot of, we talked about amenities earlier, and what we've seen in the corporate world is that amenity, for the GM building, we're doing a whole floor of amenities. And this was kind of led by WeWork. It wasn't invented, but they kind of had this idea that there was more going on. There was a ping pong table. There was, you know, if you wanted someone to do a yoga workout, that you didn't have to leave. Somebody could come to you. There's a bar or a lounge, conference rooms. And all this was led by same thing as in multifamily, where in the multifamily world, they were making apartments smaller, but offsetting it with a bunch of amenities that you could go use. So if you're with your roommate and you're sharing a tiny, you know, or maybe you're a couple and you're in a small one bedroom, if somebody wants to work now, there's a co-working space in the apartment building, or there's a lounge, or you can go find yourself a nook in a little. So the same thing's happening with office buildings, where they're squeezing more and more people into the same amount of space, but they're offsetting that by having these beautiful amenities where, And I think that'll be one of the things that we will definitely have. I can certainly say when we move to our new space is we will have a space where there'll be this much more communal living room with a bar and seating and casual seating and everything else, which is nothing new. But certainly we probably weren't rushing towards it. But now, absolutely, I really want to get away from my desk. And I think that was kind of the big thing that I took away from it, is that change of environment is really healthy for you during the day.
Yeah, I think throughout this past year, we've learned a lot. We've learned a lot about how to work and how to live and how to play in new ways. And some of those ways are a very positive change. And so it'll be very interesting to see what the next 10 years looks like in the way we work and play.
Yeah. And it's funny, you know, thinking about, I mean, I know you look at small firms, and I still think of us as a small firm. And it's kind of interesting if I'll still think like that in 5 years. Like, I wonder when that changes. I still think we're a complete startup. Like, if, you know, I get really depressed thinking it's been 18 years. It feels like 18 months. So I'm always kind of wondering if that feeling ever changes where you kind of relax into your business. I don't know.
I doubt it.
Oh, don't say that.
Well, then I think it's always evolving. It's always growing. I think it does go back to building the business, right? I think it does go back to that conversation we were having before. The better the business, the more systems you have in place, the more automation you have in place, the more predictability you can build into your business, the more freedom you have as a designer and an architect and to be able to do those things that you love to do because all those other things are taken care of.
I was trying to work out, why did we become a bigger firm though? I thought it's kind of interesting. Like, you know, was it just always predestined that we would, or what are the things that kind of get you to that point? And I was trying to work out, would it be nicer because one of the depressing things about being a bigger firm is that you know, you become more corporate and you don't know the names of everybody or what they're up to, or what their families are doing or where they're from. Like it becomes, and it was definitely much more fun when we were smaller, like, you know, saying somebody had whoopee cushions on, you know, people's chairs. Well, I can't do that now, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, it's like, so, you know, I think it was kind of interesting. It's like, was it and if we hadn't, would I still be enjoying it or not? It was kind of interesting because I think in New York, you kind of have to be certain size to survive, right? Like, but there's many ways of being an architecture practice and having a really wonderful life. But these big cities tend to require bigger practices just because the projects are so big.
Yeah.
So I often kind of think about that. I'm like, is it just like, did I?
It sounds like it's time to go back to the advice of your business consultant and look at it as a design project and say, well, now I'm a firm of 100 plus. How do I, right? The problem is I'm not having the fun that I used to have. I'm not having that feeling that I used to have. How do I do that, right? And then come up with the design, the solution to do that. How do we redesign our current business structure in order to accommodate those things and make it a more pleasurable place to work for you?
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. And I think also one of the things I'm looking forward to is not being a pandemic advisor. Like, you know, like the last year and a half has been, you know, we've all had long months and everything else, but I mean, I remember our staff, and just like January of this year, it was just really a dark time for everybody. Like, had Christmas, we gave everybody 2 weeks off and said, just forget about us or whatever it was. Like, don't think about it. And then everybody came back and it was the same. And I think, you know, trying to keep everybody's morale, trying to kind of that it's all part of what, but this, that worrying about your staff, worrying about their healthcare, worrying about, you know, their employment. It's been a long year, and I think I'm looking forward to not being a pandemic director and being an architect again, because it has been that has been, I think, much more stress than I thought it was going to be. You know, you kind of like in a normal time, you know, you can, if the market starts tanking on you, you can say, well, look, they can find another job. But in a pandemic, their healthcare is at risk, right? Like, you can't let it, like, you know, you've, it's a whole different set of things that you're trying to manage and deal with. And so we were lucky, we were able to kind of keep almost everybody and get enough work. One of the nice things is, because of Zoom, we were able to get work in different places, Miami, Atlanta, you know, Boston, because the client didn't mind where we were either. So, you know, I think that's another big advantage that we've seen.
Yeah. So it's been, there are lots of changes for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. As we wrap up here, Chris, I want to ask you the one question that I ask everybody. We're talking to thousands of small firm architects, lots of them business owners. What would you say, having all 18 years of experience of building it from scratch, what would you say is one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I think you kind of said it right. It's like, find out if you're doing it because you enjoy it, then I think it's fine, and be whatever size you need to be. I mean, like, don't get big. I mean, I still love what I do. I mean, I don't stop drawing. Like, just like that kid who was growing up all those years ago, I just draw more and more. And the iPad actually gives me more freedom to do it, right? So I think do your passion, whatever that leads you to be. But if you want to, like, I think some people who have small practices really like them to be that. And I think that's good. My method, my role isn't right for everybody either. So, but I do think the business side of it is the key, because that's the bit that allows you to relax and enjoy the stuff you're doing. If you can get that bit of the engine, like, I can't tell you how many clients or friends or architects or whatever have gotten screwed over by clients because they just didn't invoice. And, you know, right. by the time they get right. around to invoicing, the client goes, I don't remember you did this and that. And they, and, you know, just send the invoice. That was one of the first things we did, is send the invoice out every month religiously, collect the money. I think we've barely ever not had any money not paid to us. And yet I've had a lighting designer lost $600,000 on some projects in the Middle East because his architect he was going through as a consultant went under and left him holding this. But I'm like, but why won't you invoice? He said, well, I just never got to sending the invoice. Like, So I think the business side is it. I think that's the key. You know, we got the manpower software. You could get some, like, right at the beginning, just tracking our times. We're all awful at it. You know, every architect hates doing time cards. But again, all that kind of boring stuff, if you can get it running in the background, and finding somebody you trust with your books, I mean, like, all those kind of basic stuff, allowing you to kind of have the freedom to do what you want to do, but you really have to put work in to make it work.
Focus on the fundamentals and then have more time to do the fun.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's like everything, just take that time to get it right, and then you can get it's worth it in the long run.
Yeah. His name is Chris Fogarty. You can find him and his firm at fogartyfinger.com. The firm's name is Fogarty Finger. We will have information on the show notes, have all those links on the show notes. You should go check out the website. Beautiful work, beautiful portfolio. Check out Instagram at Fogarty Finger. Chris, this has been a really great conversation. I really enjoyed talking with you and learning about you and your firm. Thanks for coming on and joining us and sharing your knowledge here at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. That's how Entree Architect Podcast will grow to serve thousands more architects just like you. Thanks to our sponsors, FreshBooks and RCAT, for their support of this episode. Links to our sponsors and all the resources we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode, found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. And check out Entree Architect Academy membership. Ready to edit business resources, live monthly business training for architects, a supportive architect community, and Simple Systems, our business system program developed for you, the small firm architect. It's all waiting for you at Entree Architect Academy membership, including AIA Continuing Education Learning Units. Come join me and hundreds of your entrepreneur architect friends at entrearchitect.com/join. Enroll today at entrearchitect.com/join. Thanks for listening today. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And Brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.